You ready?
Ready to go.
Ready. Okay, great. So, you know, let me start by talking a little bit about the disconnect between moral knowledge and moral action. So I'll open up with the story that happened with Dr. Coles at Harvard. Dr. Coles, the well-known psychiatrist, child psychiatrist at Harvard, who teaches a sequence of three courses on benchmaking, on moral development at Harvard. And he had a student who was the first student in her town in western Pennsylvania. It was a coal town. There was a lot of poverty. Nobody in that town had ever gone to college. She's the first one who went to college. When she got accepted to Harvard, got a partial scholarship to Harvard, they were so proud of her that there was a marching band that saw her to the train station to take her from western Pennsylvania to Cambridge. And she took all three of his courses in moral development, so a very good student, and he was shocked when after the third course, she knocks on his door and says, "Dr. Coles, I came to say goodbye to you. I'm leaving college." He said, "What are you talking about? You're so brilliant, and you're the pride of the your town. I always think about you. How could you be leaving?" She said, "Let me tell you." She says, "You just taught me three courses in basically a Menschlichkeit, in moral development. Three courses. And do you remember who got number one? Who was the highest A in the class?" Because they would post the grades. And he named the name of a guy who's somebody the third, whose name is on the front of, last name is on the front of a lot of the buildings at Harvard, very prominent patrician family. She says, "So he got the top grade in all three classes." She said, "I can't afford to go to this school based on my scholarship. It's not enough. My family has no money. So I put myself through school by cleaning apartments all over this area." And this boy, this young man, he has a penthouse apartment off campus. And I was the maid in that apartment. She says, "It just happened." She said, "He and his friends, every time I went to clean the apartment, they tortured me. They tortured me nonstop. They tried to make me do demeaning work. They taunt me." She says, "And he was the cruelest of them all." Then she stands up and she looks at Dr. Cole. She says, "Any institution that has such a disconnect between moral knowledge and moral action, I don't want to be part of." And she leaves his office. He never sees her again. Okay? Very sad. But the question is how do we bridge the gap? What does psychology and what does Yahadus tell us about the bridging of the gap? So this is it's a relatively short talk, okay? Unfortunately, I have to catch a plane that, with tighter connections than I anticipated. But I'm going to start with mistakes. I touched on it when I spoke to the Mechanchim. How many of the Mechanchim were there Thursday night when I spoke with the Kolo? Nobody? Oh, good. So, because I was going to try to change it, so I don't have to worry about repeating myself. So I'll be able to repeat some of that stuff. So let me start with the power of mistakes. I'm going to start with the story of Dr. Olinger, O-L-I-N-E-R. Dr. Olinger, when he was 10 years old, one horrible day in his small town in Poland, the Nazis, Yimach Shemam, came, and right in front of him, destroyed everybody he ever knew. His parents, his siblings, his grandparents, all of his neighbors. In the chaos, he runs away. And he goes to the outskirts of his town. There's a farmhouse there. And he knocks on the door. And the people in the farmhouse, not only did they take him in at tremendous risk to their life, we all know what the Nazis would do to them and their friends and their family, but they treat him like one of their own for the entire war. They loved him. They educated him. They taught him how to live. I mean, you can imagine what a moral giant. I often think, could I have done that? No, I mean I just don't understand how anybody could have that level of clarity about what's right and not right, or that level of courage. I mean, it's so unbelievable. So he survives. They protect him, and after the war, an uncle comes and gets him, and takes him, I think, off to the Five Towns. Okay, it's that family. It's that family. So many of you know the family, right? And he goes on to get a PhD in sociology. And he marries a woman with a PhD in sociology. And he spends, together with his wife, his entire career answering one question. What is the family background like of somebody who ends up being a future righteous Gentile? Future Hasidei Umos Olam. What's it like? And what's fascinating is the theme came through of what it was like. And he wrote, together with his wife, a series of a number of books. And they're amazing guides to parenting. But I'm going to just focus on one of the main findings. It's how mistakes were handled in those homes. How mistakes were handled. If you made a mistake, you can't go through life without making a mistake. If you somehow violated the rules of the family, here's what the parents would do. They would hold you accountable. They'd hold you accountable, but calmly. They would very, very calmly say, we know that you're better than this. We know that you're better than this. They would just say that in a way that... would then insist that they do a tshuva process. But it was done with such gentleness and such calmness, but most importantly, with such clarity. Here's how you violated the rule of the way we think you should live your life. Let's figure out, how do we make it right? How do we make it right? What's the tshuva process that you could have? And it was done in a way that allowed for the internalization of the values in a way that made them into these moral giants. It's how you handle your mistakes. Mistakes is one of the, if it's handled correctly, often we don't see that, it's one of the major forces that are shaping the moral development of our children. You know, it's and we often don't think about it, but it's really... You know, having them know you're better than this, and then correcting them, and having that go on. Let me tell a story of Keith Jarrett. Okay. By the way, let me just give the Jewish end of this. We're told by Chazal, "Ein Adam Omed Al Divrei Torah Elim Keinichshol Behem." You can't master Torah without being frustrated and without failing. Unfortunately. Today, many parents have a hard time understanding that kids can't thrive if you protect them from their mistakes. Kids need to face their mistakes. Want to hear something amazing? If I gave you my PowerPoint on today's on this class, okay? And I purposely had about 4 of the 20 slides blurry, so you wouldn't be able to make it out. 4 of the 20 slides are blurry. You'll remember the blurry slides better than anything else because you have to make more effort. When you have to make more effort, when you have to like go and you're struggling with the Gemara or you're struggling with something that you're learning, you're going to master that much better. But if a parent protects a child from that, it's robbing them of one of the major sources of growth. I'm going to tell a story now about Keith Jarrett. So Keith Jarrett, very well-known jazz musician, jazz pianist. So listen to this story. I just love this story. It's, because it's. I think it's directly related to this. In 1975, Keith Jarrett was booked to play a concert in Cologne, Germany, in a concert hall for 6,000 people. Sold out. For some reason that's never made quite clear, there was a very gifted concert producer. She was only 17, 18 years old. She was a teenager. And she was in charge of getting the piano and setting up the concert hall in Cologne. And he gets there very early. You have to get there early, as you know, people in the business know, in order to check out the concert piano. He gets there. It's an unbelievable disaster. All of the pads on the left side of the piano, they're not there. You could hit the keys all you want, no sound. All the keys on the right side, you hit the keys, can't hear anything. The middle keys are out of tune, but if you press really hard, it'll make some music, okay? But he can't play a concert, so he tells her, go get me another piano. She goes, all over that part of Europe, you can't get a concert-level piano in such short notice. So he tells her, okay, we have to cancel the concert. Now, this is a teenager. Can you imagine what a teenage girl would do when faced with such public humiliation? She goes crazy, you know? She says, my life is over. I can't show my face in town anymore. And she just totally has a meltdown, understandably. And he has a soft, you know, he has a big heart. He says, okay, I'll do it. And he goes on to perform a concert that to this day is the all-time best-selling jazz piano album in music history. And I even saw somewhere it might be the best-selling concert in music history. And you could download it. Not now, but you could download it. Those of you who have... You just put in Keith Jarrett, 1975, Cologne, Germany. And you could either buy it or it's on YouTube, and it is magnificent. But what you hear is he's huffing and puffing and banging down, but the challenge brings out a level of brilliance and creativity in him that is unbelievable. We can't rob our children of that. That's the way they grow. That's the way they grow. So that's point number one. My themes here will start with the letter E. I don't know why, but errors. It's, kids learning from mistakes. Remember Olener, remember Keith Jarrett, and that's point one. By the way, you know, in Paris, they realized this research also, the kids grow best from their mistakes. So every year in Paris, they have something called the Festival of Errors, where they celebrate the mistakes the kids make. The tech industry has picked up on this and has something called FailCon, which I don't know, right, which they have here, where people celebrate their errors in technology. And in the Jewish education world, the Kohelet Foundation now has an award that they give. I think a pretty decent reward. If it was like, does anybody here know the award? Was it either $25,000 or $30,000 that they give to an individual educator for presenting a Jewish educational program that you tried and that failed, and you explain why it failed and how you'll do it better the next time. The power of failure, okay? So that's point one. We're good with this? Okay? And and you see the connection with matchmaking. Okay, let's go to number two. Number two has to do with expectation. Believing in somebody. You ever notice that when somebody thinks you're funny, you're funnier? If somebody thinks you're smart, you're smarter. And if somebody thinks you're dumb, you're dumber. You know? It's a lot is what gets, kamayim upon him, upon him, kain leif, what gets bounced off at you when you're with somebody. It's all tied to that. Okay, so let's talk about it. The first thing I'm going to talk to you about is the monastery study by Dr. Ellen Langer at Harvard. So the monastery study, I once talked about this in front of Rev. David Cohn, who's a very famous, you know, New York rabbi and posek, and spends his summers in Camp Monk. And he said, the monastery study says everything Dr. Polkovitz says is true, except that the study took place in Camp Monk. That's a classic Rav David Cohn line. But listen to the monastery studies. It's amazing. Ellen Langer, famous psychologist at Harvard, takes over an abandoned monastery in the outskirts of the Harvard area, Harvard MIT area. And she has it remodeled to look like the world looked when this group of 70 to 80 and 90 year old men spent 5 days there, okay, to look like the world looked when they were 40 years old, when they were at their prime. When they were at their prime, okay? So they come in, they have black and white televisions, they have wallpaper, like wallpaper looked back when these men were 40. They had, more importantly, when the men came, they were told, think of yourselves as being 30, 40 years younger, being half your age. Treat each other like you're 40 years old. Just hang out with each other. And occupy the psychological space of a 40-year-old. And they weren't, if they had a room on the third floor, they wouldn't get help with their suitcases. They'd have to carry their clothing up one shirt at a time to the third floor. But it was 5 days of living with this unbelievable kind of weird, inhabiting of a psychological and physical space the way the world used to be for them. And then there was a comparison group that where the next week people who were also old, the same age, but they were treated like their age. So they then have a team of independent experts come and evaluate the men in both groups, not knowing which group they were in. 100% of the time they got it right. You were able to just look at the men after the week, or pictures of the men even after the week, and 100% of the time, these 8 men looked younger. They didn't make any mistakes, the evaluators. They had more physical agility. They became stronger. And then in a fascinating finding, their vision improved. They had ophthalmologists look at them, and their vision improved, okay? Which is fascinating. There's a Gemara in Shabbos about there's a sign that when you slow down, when you have the avada tembehera, losing the rush in your life, as the Baal Shem Tov would say, when you have that and you slow down, what does the Gemara say? You lose what you if you're in a rush, you lose 1/60th of your eyesight. Something like that, right? So. So what's fascinating is they're now finding this in research, that your vision is tied somewhat to your inner psychological state. It's a complex literature, but I've discussed with friends who are ophthalmologists, and they look at it and they say this bears out, but that's not for now. But anyway, in my favorite finding of the study, it wasn't published. A newspaper reporter covered the study and said that when these old men went outside of the monastery to wait for the bus to take them back to Cambridge, they spontaneously started to play a game of two-hand touch football. Okay? It's incredible. Incredible. Now, why am I talking about this? Because I think it's an incredibly important part of menschmaking. It's expectations. It's expectations. It's believing in somebody. If you believe in somebody and you have faith in their ability to act in a certain way, it gets communicated to them. If you're skeptical about their ability, I see it all the time, where kids are going to one yeshiva, where somehow they get into a bad chemistry with certain educators there, and then they switch to another school, okay? Or sometimes we'll deliberately arrange, it's like a prisoner exchange or like a trade, you know. We'll send you this kid, we'll take one of your kids, and sometimes you have Mishana Makom, Mishana Mazal, a real shift in that area. I think it's fascinating, but you all know it. It's just, I think, a real reality in life, okay? There's a fascinating Gemara about Rav Shimon Bar Yochai, grandson, and I realize I don't have time for the Gemara. Another time, I'll tell you the Gemara. It's a fascinating Gemara, but it's basically, Rav Shimon Bar Yochai has a grandson that is tremendously out of control. Tremendously out of control in his behavior. And he uses his charisma and his good looks and his brilliance to go in the opposite direction of his father and his grandfather. So the Gemara says they did 3 things to deal with him, okay? First is they get him a mentor. They get him his mother's brother to mentor him. Because you have a mentor who believes in you and guides you, it makes all the difference. Then, the Gemara says, they give him a fresh start. They move him to another neighborhood. But the most amazing thing they do is they give him smicha. They give him smicha. They make him a rabbi. This totally out of control guy. They make him into a rabbi. Moshe Feinstein, you know, asks about it and says, well, you know, they probably held the klaf up to him as, right? Is that, you know, that it wasn't, that you could earn this, you know? You could get this, but if you look at the simple Gemara, they give him smicha. And when he dies, they take him up to Meiron to bury him next to his father and grandfather. And he would have been allowed to be buried there, but a divine voice comes out and says, you can't. So they say, so because of the sins of his youth, they say, no, he did tshuva for that. He deserves to be buried here, but he had way too easy a life. So that's why they don't allow him to be buried there. But it's an amazing story about believing in somebody. And just a quick thing on the concept of the word busha. Okay? The word busha, the word shame, there's such a thing as positive shame, where you teach your kids, it's like the demust yukno moment of Yosef, where he stops himself with Ashes Potiphar by seeing the image of his father and of his father's expectations, okay? So busha, according to this, it's a break in the flow. It's etymologically, some people say, tied to the word yavesh, you know, break in the flow of water, okay? Two times in Tanakh you have that word. It's Vayar Ha'am Ki Boshesh Moshe. Moshe is holding back from coming down the mountain. Sisera's mother is worried that her son, the general, isn't coming back. Ki Boshesh Milavo. It's about a pullback. In every culture in the world, there's the same nonverbal for busha. It's pulling back and looking down in shame. And what that's about is asking the question, am I better than this? Is this the way I was raised? Did I grow up in a home where this is what was expected of me, or am I violating that? And that's a very constructive way to get kids to internalize values. Okay? Let me pick a final thought and a final story. And it's about something called ethical fading. And it's there's a field at University of Pennsylvania, no, at Harvard, called a neuroethics. Neuroethics, which is a very interesting field where they look at how we make ethical and moral decisions. And what they find is that whenever people are asked, what's the right thing to do in this situation? And you present like a business ethics question or an interpersonal question, everybody knows the right thing to do, okay? And if you look at the picture of the brain, the way it lights up at that point, it's the place we put on the Shel Rosh every morning. It's the prefrontal cortex. It lights up because we know what to do. Almost everybody knows what the right thing is to do. It's often common sense, and it also reflects our values. But as soon as self-interest is involved, something takes over. And Adam Karovets Alatzma, you don't even think about it. You think you're thinking rationally, but you tend to make unethical decisions with that because you get blinded. The part of the brain that takes over has you see the trees and not the forest, and there's a whole different kind of thinking with ethical fading. And you have to be able to ask people and train your kids, sometimes with games like Ethical Dilemmas, but let me share with you the story of Illish, okay? Then after the story of Illish, I'll do a concluding story, and then we'll be able to go, okay? Here's the story of Illish. Anybody know the story of Illish? Okay, so in the Gemara, during one of the persecutions against the Jews, there was a man named Illish who was imprisoned, okay? Now, it was known that Illish was the Dr. Doolittle of the time. He spoke the language of the birds, okay? Whatever that means, he spoke the language of the birds, and he's thrown in with the cellmate, a non-Jew, who also spoke bird, but not as well. Illish was the master. And he's in the cell, okay, and a raven flies in and says, Illish, run for your life, run for your life. Elish turns to his cellmate and says, excuse me, what did the raven say? And the cellmate says, Elish, you're the master. He said, run for your life. Elish doesn't listen because the ravens aren't so trustworthy. You don't listen to ravens so easily. Then, the Gemara tells us, a dove flies in. Dove says, run for your life, run for your life. Again, Elish turns to the cellmate and says, what did he say? And the cellmate says, run for your life. And now, Elish runs for his life, okay? Because you could trust the dove. So, the obvious question asked by Rav Akiva Eiger and then elaborated in a beautiful essay by Rav Chaim Shmulevitz is, why does this great expert, why the need to turn to a cellmate? He knows more than anybody about this. Why turn to the cellmate? So he answers, because a man hears what he wants to hear and disregards the rest. To quote two RJJ boys, okay? A man hears what he wants to hear and disregards the rest. Elish knew that he wanted nothing more in life than to be told to run for his life. But he knew that because he had that self-interest, he wasn't going to think clearly and he had to turn to somebody else. We have to teach our kids to understand this ethical fading, to turn to us or turn to a trusted person to ask them. I play a game called Ethical Dilemma, okay? And it's, I play with my grandchildren. I was saying this to the Revitsons upstairs. Sorry for the repetition, okay? There's one, any other Revitsons who are there? No, only one. So it's okay. Don't listen to this. So Ethical Dilemma goes like this, okay? My grandchildren, when they come for Shabbos, I'll walk them to Shul. You'd think it would be a nightmare to have a grandfather who's a psychologist playing this game with them. They love it. They fight with each other to play it. And I talk to them about things that happen to them during the week or things that happen to me that pose either halachic questions or ethical questions. And life is filled with it. But we often don't talk to our kids about it. And they love talking about it. And then after they talk about it, I have them go and talk to their parents. What would you do? And what is your understanding of what halacha tells us to do here? What's your understanding in terms of what the right thing is to do? And it builds up the muscle. So I'll just end with this story, and then I have to end with a more inspiring story. But this, maybe I'll just end with this story anyway, because I have a plane to catch, okay? With apologies. I'm at a Pesach program. I'm at a Pesach program.
Which one?
It was in California. It was in the Canadian Rockies. It was something. I don't even remember. But it was a wonderful program. Very nice program. And they have a camp for the kids in the program. And one of my granddaughter, who was then 9, was with a group of girls, and they decided to disappear their counselor. I mean, to make believe that their counselor wasn't there. Make believe she's not here. It's a very painful thing for somebody. And my granddaughter was getting upset. She just didn't feel right to her. So she runs to my daughter, and she says, Ima, I have an ethical dilemma. Tell me what to do. And my daughter talked it out with her, and she went and told the girls that she doesn't want to do it, and they avoided her for the rest of Pesach, but we were very proud of her, okay? Let me end with the story, okay? The final E is emotion and emphasis. Emotion. What do we get emotional about? And what do we emphasize? What we get emotional about is physical things or material things. It's not good. If what we get emotional about is core values, you know, that are at the core of the way we want our children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren to live their lives, it's a whole other deal. So I'm going to end with a story about that, again, because I'm in the year for my father, and it goes like this. I went to Camp Monk as a kid, okay? It was a camp in the mountains, very nice camp. But the way to be a hero in camp, in that camp, was to be a star athlete. And I was anything but a star athlete. Okay, I'd be in the outfield when they'd hit a ball, and I'd be thinking about I don't know what. Okay, so at the end of the year, the end of the summer, every kid would get an award. You get an award, and the dream was to get an award of best in baseball, best in tennis, best monk rabbat. They had like a circus where you had to do I don't know. It was always athletic awards. And every year I was there, year after year, I came home with what I consider to be the loser award, which was best midos. And I was so embarrassed. I was a kid. Like, who what? That's, you give the best midos award to the kid who's a klutz and can't do anything that boys that age value. And every year the same thing would happen, okay? I would get the award. I would bury it underneath my trunk. And I remember my mother, Allah Shalom, my father, Allah Shalom, come home. And I realized now they were playing with me because they wanted to make a point. They said, David, get an award? I said, no awards this year. They canceled the awards. And my mother would always go through the trunk. And then they'd call me into the room. This happened at least three times that I remember, holding the best midos award, okay? And with tears in their eyes, they would say, David, this is our dream. This is all we care about. Do you think we care if you're a decent athlete? You think that's going to matter down the road? What we care about is you be a mensch. That's all that matters to us. And there's something about the emotion and the emphasis and that value that it gets to you. It gets to you. So just remember, monitor what you're raising your kids and grandchildren with. Monitor what you emphasize. Monitor what you get emotional about, okay? And that's going to be the key to raising a mensch. Thank you, everybody. I apologize for leaving. I feel so badly, but it's my plane is at 1 o'clock. It's
you need a
They're under the chair.
Thank you so much.
I'm good.
How are you?
If you can do it, you can.
Ayala.
You're going to take a look while I wait for a minute.
I'll meet you up there.
That's wonderful. I hope you have a kosher lunch.
Yes, I ran into my grandson.